Destroying miles of celluloid every single week. This is Film Sack. Oh, sure.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Film Sack. This is Film Sack, the podcast dedicated to mining the dark depths of Netflix streaming for the betterment of mankind. This is episode 2, and I'm Scott Johnson. Joining me tonight is Brian Dunaway.
Hi, how's it going? I got a little bit of a nasally thing tonight.
Oh, good stuff. Randy Jordan.
This is Randy Jordan, and I have just decided to leave my dolphin pets over in the corner and come record this podcast with you.
Excellent. And Brian Ibbett, also known as Bibby. I can't do it. Bibby.
Well, good. What the heck is this big black thing doing in my room?
What?
That's
oh, it's stuff. A. You got your own little. What's it
That's
called?
It's a monolith. Come on,
monolith.
Oh,
What's the proportions on that?
Yeah, what is it like?
Why, that would be 1:49, 1x4x9.
Very
three
nice.
Perfect
are
squares.
Are there monkeys hucking bones around, or is it just you in there? Just wondering.
Just me.
Okay. Well, welcome back to the show. This is, of course, Film Sack, and we are excited to talk about this week's show. Let's let Scott Fletcher do the honors.
...2010, the year we make contact. In this stunning sequel to 2001, A Space Odyssey, ex-NASA chief Haywood Floyd helms a U.S.-Soviet mission of scientists trying to rendezvous with the abandoned Discovery spacecraft to reactivate the homicidal HAL 9000 computer and learn the truth. Set with Earth on the verge of nuclear war, this tense epic from director Peter Hyams earned 5 Oscar nods.
Wow, 5, dude.
I just can't believe how great Scott Fletcher does in that. I mean, I know he's awesome. Very talented. I knew he was great, but
you didn't know how great until now.
I just did not know that.
Well, we found his favorite thing in the world because he's so excited to be a part of this, and we couldn't be more thrilled. I'm just so happy to have his silky voice making more of that summary page on Netflix than I could ever do on my own.
Absolutely.
So thank you, Scott Fletcher. So let's talk about 2010, the year we make contact, the sequel to a 1968 film, 2001, which was directed by Stanley Kubrick, which both these books are based on, or excuse me, movies are based on books. And the first one came out before I was born, and the second one came out when I was 13 or 14.
Yeah.
So my first exposure to anything 2000-something movies was this movie. I'd never seen the 68 one until much later. So I actually saw these in reverse order. I'm not going to lie to you, and I'll say it right up front. I'm still not 100% sure what the hell happened in either movie.
Yeah.
but we'll get to that, and we'll talk a little bit about it. The main actor in this movie is, of course,
Roy Scheider,
most famous for his turn in Jaws and Jaws 2. Yeah. Also, Blue Thunder. Remember that?
Yes, great show. Not as good as Airwolf, but all at the same time.
Well, Blue Thunder had the movie, and then it did the TV show. And was he in the TV show? I don't remember if he tried to have a TV career.
Was
on that.
He in the TV show?
He was. He wasn't in that, but he was in Sequest.
I don't think he was.
Oh, yeah, Sequest. That's right.
With his dolphins. That, he has his own dolphins. He
now
brings on set.
Scott.
He is
now,
all about the dolphins.
Yeah, Scott suddenly gets Randy's comment from the top of the show.
Yeah.
Jeez, that took me a while.
And rest in peace, Roy Scheider. He passed away earlier. Last year.
He did a really cool voiceover in a documentary that uses animation sequences for telling the story of this courtroom stuff, and it's awesome. I highly recommend it. If I knew the name, I'd tell you, but I don't. Can't remember it.
Died from pneumonia because he always wears shorts in every movie he's in.
Oh, dude. Too soon. Anyway, so you got Roy Scheider. You got him as Dr. Haywood Floyd. Terrible name. Yep. John Lithgow. Yep. Is also in this movie, fresh out of his stint in Harry and the Hendersons, I believe, as Dr. Walter Cumnow.
Still had some of that hair on him he couldn't get off. Gum, that spirit gum's kind of, you know.
I'm sorry, it's Walter Cornow, not Walter Cumnow. Also, Helen Mirren, Helen Mirren is in this. Wow, Helen, the queen herself, she's in this. And she plays a Russian, which really threw me for a loop, but she's awesome as in anything.
I wouldn't have known otherwise if I didn't really realize who it was until a little later on into the movie, and I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, and you got yourself.
But she did a great job.
You got Douglas Rain returning as the voice of the HAL 9000. You got some other interesting characters and people. You basically have the Yakov Smirnoff 80s Russian stereotype in full effect in this movie, and we have a lot to say about it. Let's start with a little intro. This is some bad English, and the reason I picked this clip is because this guy that comes to get Scheider out of his boring teaching job as some kind of astronomy science dude at some university, he comes to get him, and he's supposed to be playing a Russian. The problem is, I'm not stupid, and I've seen this guy in about 20 other movies, and he was always an American dude in them all. So he's not fooling me at all. Here's some of his crappy-sounding Russian.
Someone had to be blamed, so it was you. You like being a teacher?
I don't think I like you.
I just read your final report on what happened to Discovery. You left a good number of loose edges.
Ends.
Loose ends, yes. Thank you.
Took you this long to steal our secrets?
How long does it take for your people to steal ours?
All right, two things are wrong with that. One, that's an American dude with a terrible accent.
You
can't fool me. He's in like all these cop movies. He's always like a chief of police or some kind of DA guy.
Totally.
That is not his voice. Second of all, this begins what I think will be a theme today a little bit about the main problems I have with this movie. Not that we're only picking movies that we have problems with, but, and I know Randy's going to probably argue a lot of this, but I think that the overtone of political intrigue about Russia, U.S., Cold War stuff is way over the top in this.
This is 84 movie, another great 84 movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff happened in 84. Temple of Doom, this, Kroll, that we talked about last week, you know, a week ago.
Yeah.
What else? Other big stuff that year. There's all kinds of stuff that year. Didn't we get Back to the Future, maybe?
We totally looked. Yeah, I forget. We had a big list. I mean, there's a huge, huge amounts of 19. Someone needs to start a website.
Yeah, that's something.
Yeah.
So, 1984 was the year of Ghostbusters, Beverly Hills Cop, Gremlins, Karate Kid. A really big year at the movies.
For nerds. At the
blockbuster movies, even more so. You know, those... all those movies I just named were huge grossers.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. It was crazy. So, speaking of huge grossers, no, I actually don't have a good transition there. So let's talk about the kind of breakdown of some of these things. So you've got a fairly sizable cast of people. Most of them are guys I swear I've seen in 100 other movies as terrorists and other things. They play these Russian cosmonauts.
I mean it's every stereotypical Russian actor that was working in the 80s, you know, whether they were on Moscow on the Hudson or any of those movies where they had to actually have like a bunch of Russians.
Yeah.
These are the guys you went to.
And these are guys that died early in Die Hard, you know, things like that.
Or that last all the way to the end of Rocky IV.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I would break you.
Yeah, so it's definitely a who's who of second list sort of actors back then. But having Helen Mirren, and Helen Mirren was no small actress in those days either. She was, you know, highly respected. And the fact that it took me a little while to go, oh, wait, that's Helen Mirren. She had me convinced. She seemed as Russian as any Russian I've ever known, which is I've only known Russians in the movies, so I probably don't know any. But you know, she didn't disappoint. I thought she was okay. I thought Scheider way overacted through this whole thing, and I think I think for a guy who I think is normally a really great actor, he was over the top.
Yeah.
Randy, you disagree?
No, I was going to say the best actor in the film for me was Bob Balaban, and I'd forgotten he was in it. I was shocked when I saw him, and when I heard him, I thought, okay, is this Jason Alexander? Because he would have been like a teenager.
Yeah.
And it sounded just like him, and I stared at him for a while, and I realized, oh my gosh, it's that guy from all the Christopher Guest films.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, when Balaban was in his 30s, he looked and sounded just like George from Seinfeld.
And
it got me thinking about ages. And then Roy Scheider is you know, married to a woman who's 27 years old. He's in like his 50s.
Yeah, no, it's weird. It's weird.
Yeah.
His wife is hot. But Bob Balaban was also on Seinfeld. Is it not?
Yeah, little... he was the head of NBC.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That was a great little storyline. But actually, that storyline kind of depressed me in the end. But anyway, we don't want to talk about Seinfeld. But that guy's great. He's usually in comedic roles. This is great to see him in, as this kind of squirrely, nervous dude. And I'm 100% with Randy. He was the best performance of the film.
Yeah.
Although I do like Dave, the guy that keeps coming back from the first movie. I think that guy's good.
Kier Duella,
I think is his name.
I can't remember how his name is pronounced.
Sacagawea?
Yeah, but he's the whole...
Dule.
It's full of stars. Sacagawea? Yeah. What? All these guys I think were pretty good. The Russians I thought were the worst. I keep illustrating my whole problem with the techno babble mixed with political nonsense of 80s movies, because I've got a great clip right here for that.
Why in the hell is it going to crash?
I don't know. It's bizarre. Unless it's got something to do with that monolith up there.
You see that building behind us? I'm supposed to go in there to have lunch in a half an hour. Of course, there's one good thing about a reactionary president. He's not in hell foods. The last one, we didn't lunch. We grazed. You want to know what lunch is about? I'll tell you. We've got two more aircraft carriers off the coast of Honduras. The Russians are moving some of their big stuff. Now you got the Joint Chiefs screaming about Russian satellites with anti-missile lasers on them. So we got to send up our laser satellites to counteract theirs. So the president has come to the conclusion that the NCAA should be placed under the jurisdiction of the Defense Department. Enough with the crazy scientists spending all this money trying to talk to Martians.
Yeah, we need to move the tanks over there to counter the Russian moves and the thing with the stuff and the deal. And I'm not a fan of that. I feel like that was so played out, and it felt like it was artificially played out. Like it was just, I understand we make movies about our day and about our time, and this was a reflection of that in some way. When the whole thing is just wrapped up in this whole who's going to hit the red button first and Baryshnikov freaking, I just, that kind of stuff drives me a little crazy.
I remember that being so huge though in the mid 80s. I mean, I remember, so many songs in the 80s, the stuff Frankie Goes to Hollywood was doing, of course, besides Relax, was really, really big on the Cold War. I remember other movies tackling it. I remember, it was
a scary time.
It was a scary time, and it was, I just remember seeing it on everything, the front of Time magazine week after week after week with the pictures of Reagan and Gorbachev going head to head.
Doesn't it kind of strike you, though, as not as scary as, or meaning not as scary, it was made more scary than it was? Like, it was blown out of, just like if we go see movies about terrorists now, that seems really scary because we connect it with a real world thing and it seems awful and terrible and everything. But I feel like we're going to get a decade or two past now and look back and go,
I don't think we are. I think the Russians are doing a land grab thing right now, and I think we're going to see a new Cold War.
You think so? With the Russians?
I think all this is going to come around.
Look at us getting all political. Go ahead, Randy.
I was very illuminated by how well that story held up, quite frankly. I went the opposite way with this film. And that scene you just played, that performance by James Micken, just sitting there opposite Roy Scheider and delivering really difficult dialogue that was really clever, too. I was really impressed. Like, that's probably my favorite scene in the film, because they let him film right out in front of the White House, which it's difficult. I don't know how you would get that space nowadays for a film. I guess you've got to pay somebody. But, that the dialogue by Peter Hyams and Arthur C. Clarke, I think, probably wrote most of that scene, was just awesome, and they got the perfect guy to do it. You couldn't have had a better actor.
Exactly. He done a great Morgan Freeman impression.
I was going to say the exact same thing. That's hilarious, Brian.
He did. He sounded a lot like Morgan Freeman. In fact, I think it's the first scene you see that guy, and it's so far away you can't tell who he is. And I went, I said, what? Is Morgan Freeman like a non-credited dude in this?
Yeah.
Yeah, that surprised me. How dead on that was.
Very similar voices. But yeah, I do agree with Randy that was some of the best dialogue. I think I don't want to sum the movie up too soon before we get into the real big details, but my impression was I thought it was a good movie. I don't think it was artistic as the first one, and I think that threw people for a loop because it was more political. But I think as a movie on its own, I think it holds up. I think it did very well.
All right. Yeah. It has its moments. Let's listen to another one of them. The fabled HAL 9000 is the computer that is still aboard the ship they're trying to get back to which is orbiting Jupiter's moon. And they have other computers now that have been upgraded. And I always like watching old 80s or past, you know, any movies before the internet.
Yeah.
So that I can kind of see what the hell they were thinking about computers.
Yeah.
They now have a model called the Sal, and it's a chick.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here is.
Should have been an old Italian guy.
That's what I think.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking.
Some hitman. Hey, what are you doing? Dave, I can't. I'm sorry. I can't do that. doesn't quite sound, it doesn't give you the same vibe, but
open the pot bay doors, forget about it.
We've spoken about Hal's anomalous behavior. You have told me that we cannot solve the problem of Hal's behavior without more information.
That is correct. I enjoy talking about Hal. I agree that we need more information so that we may solve the anomalies.
And how do we get that information?
That is obvious. Someone must return to Discovery. That person should be you.
Well, I agree. And now it looks as if that is going to happen much sooner than we ever expected.
I am pleased to hear that.
Oh, I knew you would be.
Oh, Candace Bergen at 37 years old. I just want to jump her bone so bad.
I was just going to say.
If I had a computer that sounded like that, wow.
Yeah. That's amazing. So today, you know, it's always so funny to put this stuff in a place where in 84, people saw computers as, I don't mean to use the word as a pun here, but monolithic machines of mystery and complexity and expense and all of these other things. And it just seems outrageous that anybody would have these in their homes. I mean, these are still like these crazy things that nobody could really get their hands on. So they make it out to be so mysterious and self-aware and sentient and all this kind of stuff. And now, you know, I use my iPhone to call Randy, and all I got to do is say, call Randy Jordan. Calling Randy Jordan, mobile. And it sounds just like this chick. So we've come a long way, baby, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
and I love that totally. In that very same scene, you see Bob Balaban's computer in the background, and they think that computer monitors went exactly the opposite way that they that they did. Instead of getting thinner, this one was like 4 feet deep.
Yeah,
it was
like
a monitor that
that thing was huge. It was like a it was like his trailer over there. It was gigantic. But I also noticed that they said, okay, well, Hal has a harsh red light eye thing, whatever. So Sal will have a nice blue soft one.
Yeah.
So I just
don't like that.
It's an interesting little trope. I thought it was.
She's the Bluetooth model. You know, it's.
I see. They're way ahead of themselves then. They didn't know what they had. So anyway, there's that.
It was funny that the computer was shaped very similar to, you know, our tower desktops now.
Oh, I know. It's very similar.
Yeah.
Sort of,
yeah.
Except it was built into a much larger thing. But if you kind of squinted, it would kind of stand on its own.
Yeah.
And be kind of cool. And I have a great HAL 9000 desktop background that's just awesome. That eye's just always looking at me.
Yeah.
I'm trying to look at porn.
You like
Scott.
That, do you? You like for HAL to look at you?
404 Air, Scott.
By the way, don't search the credits of the film for Candace Bergen. She goes under a pseudonym for some reason in this film. It makes you wonder if she didn't like the film, didn't like the performance, didn't get paid right, or what.
Yeah.
But she goes under this the horrible name Olga Malznerd in the credits.
Wow.
Hey, why not?
Maybe Scheider took a pass at her in his short shorts or something.
Yeah, in his shorty short shorts.
You know what's funny is when you first see him and his 27-year-old wife, I got to say that again.
Yeah.
You can't help but think, my gosh, he's twice her age, which he really was at that time.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
the very next shot is of him with his shirt off, and the next thing you think is, wow, he's in pretty good shape for a 50-year-old.
I know, dang, man.
Not bad.
Yeah, but not too bad for a guy in his 50s. All right, well, we got this is one of my favorite moments in the movie, another clip. This is typical in movies where they're trying to build a lot of tension. So on the bridge of whatever spaceship you're on, they have some kind of obnoxious noise that builds in intensity until you're ready to turn the thing off.
No,
I'm
don't play that.
I'm doing it. I'm playing it.
Oh.
And the funny thing is, when I was watching it, I thought the same thing too. Because whenever they would go outside the ship, it was totally all of a sudden bass just kicked in on my system. But the one thing that was annoying me, but then I realized this is very effective, is when John Lithgow was outside outside the ship trying to get in. His breathing was very rapid.
Yeah.
And it was kind of annoying me, but after a while I was realizing this is making me feel very stressed out.
Oh yeah, that was a pretty effective scene, I thought.
Yeah, so it was actually very effective after a while.
Despite those fuzzy lines that the old green screen tech used to give of things, and there was a lot of that happening. That scene had a kind of a dead space vibe to it that really got me. And Lithgow can put on the acting boots when he needs to.
Yeah,
and probably hasn't breathed that hard since Footloose, I was thinking.
when the only thing you're hearing is the breathing coming from inside your helmet, I thought it was a great scene, a great effect.
Yeah, I was waiting for him to puke in his helmet, by the way, because that happens. If there's a movie with space helmets, someone barfs him, always.
That's true. Yeah,
it's
the whole scene. Weren't you thinking, hasn't this guy ever gone scuba diving or like snorkeling?
If these are the elite guys that are the only guys that can go all the way to Jupiter, you'd think they'd have some training.
Right. Before we're going to blast you all the way across the solar system, we need you to go snorkeling in Bob's pool.
Yeah, just see if you can handle the pressure.
Just get the feel for it.
Oh my gosh!
That's going to give you. That's going to prepare you for walking 9 miles above Europa.
Yeah.
Or Io or whatever they were right then.
Yeah. Very cool stuff. We got another clip here. This is my most hated thing in movies. Now, we've all seen Blade Runner. And the version that they had to put out in the theaters because they were pressured by the studio has narration from Harrison Ford where he's like, "It was a cold day that day," and all that kind of film noir crap. And what's his name? I can't think of his name all of a sudden. Director Ridley Scott said, "You know, I didn't want to do that." And in all the special editions, it's out. Well, movies do this all the time, and this movie has the most egregious one I've heard in my lifetime. And it's 30 seconds roughly of this, and you got to hear it to believe it. This is terrible. This is told through a letter from Scheider, 50-something-year-old Scheider, to his 27-year-old wife.
Yes.
While he's out in space. Ridiculous.
"Dear Caroline, I miss you terribly. The time has come to put ourselves in an orbit around Io, which is where the Discovery is. We don't have enough fuel to slow ourselves down, so we are about to use a technique called aerobraking. The theory is, we will enter the outer layer of Jupiter's atmosphere using what is called a balut for a shield. The atmosphere will slow us down, and Jupiter's gravity will grab hold of us and slingshot us around behind the dark side.
I may die and never come home, but I'll go ahead and send you this letter that says, I miss you terribly. So anyway,
I'm going to add special effects to it. It sounds like I'm in outer space.
Outer space! I hate that. I hate that. Yeah. It's a way of furthering the plot and being lazy. It's like, well, we don't want to have all this exposition be shown to you. We'll just have Scheider tell it in an echoey letter that he would never write to anyone he loves. Why would he do this? He'd be saying, "I'm in a cold space, is sure lonely without you, dear. Okay, see you next time." It doesn't, you know.
That whole scene, I was waiting to hear Elrond say, "This evil cannot be concealed by the power of the elves. We do not have the strength to withstand both Mordor and Isengard." You know, like,
it would have improved it. It would have improved it. That was terrible. You have to admit.
I'll tell you that air breaking went on way too long. They could have cut out that voiceover and added something in there besides doing that air breaking, because I didn't feel stressed at all about that. It was just uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, I agree with that. So let's stop here before we go to another clip. I want to just talk about some of the things that hold up over time. When I first saw it, I thought the special effects were pretty good, and this was all, you know, of course, post-Star Wars, and I think LucasArts had a hand anyway, and so there was a lot of quality happening in terms of the space shots and all of that. We'll talk about the plot later, because I honestly still don't know what the hell happened. I don't know what that movie did in the end. I don't know where it went.
What happened?
There's an old guy. There's a baby there. What happened? They had to be out of there in 2 days. Why did they have to be out of there in 2 days exactly? I'm not sure.
It was something wonderful.
Yeah. So wonderful. Apparently it was something wonderful, and Dave is ready to do it. But so let's talk about how this thing holds up. Do you guys feel like it holds up over time, or is this movie just, are people going to see this after they hear our show and go, dude?
I think it's a movie I think that does stand on its own very well, and I think I like it. You know, I've seen both 2010 and 2001, and like you, Scott, I saw 2010 first, sat in the theaters with my dad, you know, back when I was 13, and I think as a sequel, it doesn't necessarily need to be a sequel. I mean, you've got the monoliths from the first movie. Those could be just about anything that, because the powers that the monoliths exhibit or seem to exhibit in the sequel don't happen in the first movie. So this, they could have been anything. It could have been a giant Stargate. It could have been a
giant chocolate bar floating in space.
It could have been a giant chocolate bar or a giant castle turd thing from last week.
But I don't get why. Let me dwell on that for a minute. Yeah, so you have these monoliths that play a role in both the movies in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I still don't know what they're doing. What is the deal? So they're made of stars? What the hell does that mean?
All right. Well, okay. Let's go over what we know they do.
Okay.
We know they vaporize
Russians.
We know they turn ape men into steak burgers.
Okay.
Yeah.
We know that they're capable of shooting some sort of like laser balls at things, right?
Yeah.
Like a plasma ball.
Right. And so, are they just sentinels, like standing over? Don't touch this moon. Don't come near Jupiter's moon because we'll kick your A. But
it's,
otherwise,
it's dibs. It's the universal equivalent of I call it.
Yeah, dibs. Didn't see that coming, did you? Russia, America, suckers.
Yeah.
Well, I think that the whole point of these films is that when humanity encounters another sort of life, if that life is the form of life is advanced enough, we will have no concept of how to deal with it. We won't know how to talk with it. We won't know that it's life necessarily. We won't get it at all. And I think they really drill that into you in this film.
Yeah, there was a lot of that where we would not have the comprehension. And as a moviegoer, I don't have it. Like on the poster, there's the baby and the embryo kind of shot.
Yeah.
And in the movie, it shows up and kind of stares at them all creepy. And I still find that really effective and creepy. Like it looks really good. That didn't look weird and fake to me. That looked really cool.
Yeah.
But I still don't get it. Like, do these monoliths start life on weird secondary moons around giant gas planets where there's chloroform? Is that the point? And
you'll just have to read the later books to find out.
Are there later books?
Yeah.
It's Arthur C. Clarke, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know, man.
I think the movie stands up. I think it stands on its own, and it really feels to me like almost an alternate reality type movie, where it's kind of like this is what would have happened if the Cold War had continued. You know, so it doesn't. It almost seems to me. It seems like it fits in even today.
Didn't you think the ending was a little bit like, we've got to embrace our Russian friends and everyone hug on this damn ship, and then they'll do that on Earth, and then everything will be great again. It just swept that all under the rug too easily.
Which is funny, because the ending is. Are we?
Oh, we can spoil them. Yeah, we're spoiling. Okay, okay. We can spoil the hell out of these movies.
Okay,
this movie's from 1984. Come on.
So basically, you've got the monoliths that turn Jupiter into a second star, so that you've got potential atmospheres around. I'm assuming just what were Jupiter's moons,
right.
Of a sudden those become additional worlds. And then it says, all right, hey, all these are yours, except for Europa. Don't even come near Europa. Stay away from Europa. Well, weren't we, through the future of exploration, weren't we just going to go to those planets or go to those moons anyway? Right. Weren't those going to be ours anyway?
Yeah.
And isn't the first thing that people are going to think of if the Cold War is still going on, they're going to think, all right, great. Hey, the Russians can have that one. Let's send the Russians up to Io.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, there is a bigger discontinuity here, and it drives me absolutely batty, and that is that we've got now a 9-year span, 2001, 2010. We finally make contact or whatever. But in these 9 years, we find out at the end of all this time, what, you can speak plain English to us on a screen?
Yeah.
Why haven't you been doing that all along?
Or you can just appear to us as an old man and shake your hand a little bit and then turn into a baby for a second and then be the normal Dave guy. And
I say nuke these bastards.
Nuke that moon. Yeah. Or nuke the freaking monolith.
If I remember from what I've read on the internets before, and if they are true, There's like another time span when Halley's Comet comes around again, and the central character is supposed to explore the galaxy and ends up crash landing on Europa. So we get to know more about that.
Oh, see, I could deal with that.
If you read the books later on.
Am I wrong, or do I remember this right? Star Trek IV, Voyage Home had a big giant monolith in the sky that spoke to the whales. Do I remember that right? Big old slab of something.
Yeah, more or less.
I thought it was a whale shaped thing.
It was not whale shaped. You know what? You're thinking of the animal crackers that your wife buys you on the weekends. I'm talking about this big giant. No, I think it was I don't know that it was smooth and flat and stuff. But I just want to know if that was inspired. You know, I always wonder about these things.
Yeah,
the Trek guys go, dude, we should have one of those. And instead of talking to monkeys,
we totally need a monolith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll talk to whales. And it'll be the stupidest Star Trek movie ever made.
Yeah.
I know there's some controversy about that, but that's what I believe.
Overall, I would say a movie worth watching on Netflix, especially if you're a sci-fi fan.
Okay. But Brian, did you see the guy? All you need to tell me this. There's a Russian doppelganger on the ship of Roy Scheider. Did anyone else notice this? Because there's Roy Scheider, and then there's a Russian dude with a goatee who is Roy Scheider.
Really?
That's hilarious. I did not catch that.
There are a lot of characters on the ship that just show up like in one or two scenes, and you never see them again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they're all hairy and stinky. Like what their idea of Russians in 84, they're all bearded, messy-haired, half-balding. What do you want to do with the ship? They're just the worst types.
No, of course I didn't bring a razor on this trip. What are you talking about?
But I'm telling you, I can't believe I'm the only one that saw the Scheider doppelganger. That was weird. That freaked me out.
I had to go back and watch it again.
I had to pause it and make sure I wasn't seeing things.
Now, I do like the actor who played kind of the main fun Russian, the Russian that gets zapped by the monolith that was friends with John Lithgow's character.
Got to know him while they were floating. Yeah,
exactly. He is you can see him these days as Spider-Man's landlord in the movies.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's right. Oh, yes. He hasn't aged well.
He has not aged well, no.
But he's in something else. Like he was in a Die Hard style movie or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was in Air Force One. I was looking at his resume on IMDb. And what's funny is in all the movies that he's been in, he's only played a character named Vladimir twice, but he's played about 10 Yuris.
Two Vladimirs for 10 Yuris. That's not bad.
Who played this character? It was Savlev Kramarov. He was actually really a Russian guy. Hold on a second. Let me find his real name.
Dr. Vladimir Rudenko was the character.
He was in some new movie coming out. No, that was 93. Oh, never mind. Yeah, it's called Rusky Business.
Rusky Business?
Sounds like
awesome.
Okay, we may have
one of those porno names for real movies.
We may have to see if that's in... If that's in streaming, we're doing that.
Well, I guess S-A-V-E-L-I, is how you say that? Savelli?
No, wait. No,
Kramarov? I don't know.
Dmitry Mozilevich. What's great is when someone's name is Dana Elkar and they play Dmitry Mozilevich. I like that. If you have a weird name and you're playing somebody with a weird name, just keep the name you got.
Yeah,
I don't know who it was, but my favorite Russian in the film was satisfied this need I think we all have, and that is when you're a man's man and you're on a spaceship and you're having to approach a celestial body, which means a hard burn that's going to really shake the ship and it just might kill us all. Give me a small Russian woman to kind of cling to and comfort during that time. Yeah. I think that's a very important thing.
That was creepy. She was young enough to be his daughter. That creeped me out. And I'm thinking, you know, he's supposed to be all faithful to his wife and writing her letters about how the thrusters aren't working or whatever the hell he's doing. He's in there hugging on that androgynous 15-year-old in the turbulence. I just thought that was weird. And that went on. That's another thing. That went on way too long. That kind of stuff.
Like I said, that whole scene was way too long.
Such filler. Yeah. It's like, we don't have anything to say. What do you want to do? Maybe a little bit of pedophilia there in the cockpit.
Yeah.
Dude, I just want you to know she was like 25 years old when they made the movie.
She looked really young. That's all I'm saying. And he looked way old. He looked like a chiseled old man at that point.
Yeah, 25 in Russian years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. All right, let's play another clip. This is one of my favorites of all. This is the best swear moment in the entire film.
I was told to lie by people who find it easy to lie. Hal doesn't know how. So he couldn't function. He became paranoid.
Most sons of bitches.
I know.
Scheider, seriously, that's terrible acting. Yeah. That's terrible.
That was great. I thought it was wonderful.
Oh, sons of bitches. Get your damn dirty hands off
dirty,
me.
Exactly what I was thinking.
But he comes from that school of acting, right? Like he's from that time a little bit, or maybe on the fringe of it. But those guys all did that. Like they all had that just, you've got to somehow get this ship off the planet.
Well, remember, this was back in the day when you could get a PG rating if you only allowed one swear moment in the film.
Yeah.
Kind of like nowadays, you can still hold a PG-13 if you only allow one F-bomb in a film.
Yeah, which I love.
That's the way it used to be 25 years ago. So this was the one time, and he totally blows it.
Yeah.
He just blows it.
Yeah. By the way, I just want to give some clarity here. 1984, the first two movies we've done are from 84. Kroll and this one. Kroll from last week, this one from this week. Yeah. I just want to remind people that it was only 8 years between these movies and their hokey special effects and all that, and Jurassic Park, for example.
Yeah.
Eight measly years. That does not seem right to me because everything since about 92, 93, it's really hard to tell that it's – that like if you said, oh, here's this movie from 1995, I would never go, that does not age well. Not at all.
Yeah.
It's like we've gotten to a certain, a peak. And now we're just riding on that peak with films because it just seems like everything that was old wasn't that old as compared to like just 5, 6, 7, 8 years later. Suddenly it looks like it was yesterday. And I don't get that. Like, what is
this? I get it totally. Is Lucasfilm's coming into his own? He finally got enough money and, you know, they just changed everything.
Yeah, but there's more than that. See, I mean, even Star Wars, you look back and you go, oh, some of this didn't age well. But you look at
he was still practicing.
But you look at things like even Westerns in the early 90s. Like, I'll watch Tombstone, 94, dude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that movie looks great. It doesn't have any of the trappings of some old movie. But if you took a movie, so that was how many years ago? 95 was 12 years ago?
14.
How about 14?
14 years ago. That was a long time ago. Someone was born and is 14 now since that movie came out.
Right,
it still looks great today. But if the year was 1994 and you went back 14 years, that stuff looked like garbage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything gets worse during that time. When you go from 94 to 80, scores of films get horrible. Back in the 1980 to 83 range was when they used synthesizers instead of orchestras, and it was horrible.
Yeah, you know.
And there's, I mean, you're just talking about that jump to light speed time.
Yeah,
you don't have to go all the way into the 90s. You know, like there's some pretty good films in just the late 80s as far as effects go. Like Predator was 87, RoboCop was 87. Let's see, the Fly was 86. That sort of thing.
Yeah, Aliens was 86. It's like that's a very good point. And anything John Hughes seemed to be pretty ageless. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a change in the guard or something was changing then. And it's never really gotten that much better. Like, I know the tech's gotten better. We've done amazing things with effects and some direction stuff. But generally, it seems like we've plateaued. And it's a good plateau. There's nothing wrong with where we're at. But we're not seeing these leaps. And this is true of video games. I see this in, you know, computer stuff. Lots of things have that weird time there where they hit that. And that either means the apocalypse is nigh or I don't know what I'm talking about. It could be that.
Totally.
Anyway. All right, moving on. Let's do another clip.
That was a good point.
Here is this piece of stuff that this is that scene that I still don't get to this minute. I don't know what's being said, but we'll play it anyway.
You must leave.
What? What's going to happen?
Something wonderful.
What?
I understand how you feel. You see, it's all very clear to me now. The whole thing. It's wonderful.
Please, if...
Goodbye, Dr. Floyd. We can have no further contact. Remember. You have 2 days.
We can't leave in 2 days.
There may be another message after, if all goes well.
What's going to happen?
Well, I still don't know, Roy Scheider. I still don't know what the hell's going to happen. Because here's the thing. If you can communicate with Roy, shorts or not, and be able to tell him all this stuff, and concepts like, you need to leave in 2 days, or I finally understand it and it's wonderful, and you're communicating in English and in all these sort of ways, that then why can't you say what the hell's going on? Like, why can't you really... We're hiding.
What's so hard
this?
About saying we're gonna explode Jupiter?
Well, maybe the problem is that what you have here is you've got a book that's way more into that. Like, that's way more spelled out in the book, and then you have a movie that's trying to talk to mom and pop, so they're doing letters home that don't make that spell everything out for them. So maybe that's what's happening. Thoughts on that, anyone?
Never read the book, so I can't say.
Yeah. Well, what made me wonder was the hinge. Not necessarily the discovery and the Russian ship that had to go up there, but was it the fact that the American astronauts and the Russian astronauts had to come to some kind of agreement as the trigger? Because stuff was going to happen to Jupiter regardless, right? I mean, they had 2 days to get out of there. There was nothing about what they did that was going to change what was happening with Jupiter, unless it was waiting for that establishment of peace between them to say, okay, we're going to work together to get the ship out of here, as opposed to, well, we're stuck because they're over there and we're over here, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I had to kind of pin this all on is like, okay, Bowman was saying, until you guys have figured out your own piece, you're not going to get the exploration of these other worlds and a place to grow from there.
Now, we've kind of talked about what we thought was, some of us have said what we thought was good about this movie, some of the things we think are kind of stupid and stand out. But I know, Randy, you felt like this, and you said this off air as well, you felt like this held up particularly well for a film of this type, and it's in your quote-unquote wheelhouse. What was the thing that you found the best? What stood out?
It's very, very easy to lose your way when most of your film is a bunch of actors who are trapped in a tube, basically. And so what you often have to do is you have to contrive ways to get them out of that tube. So you put them in spaceman suits and you float them around and you muffle their voices. And that's, you realize, holy crap, that's even worse. And this film didn't fall into the trap of trying to get the actors to over emote, to get across that they were scared or claustrophobic or whatever was working on them. Instead, this movie uses really simple things like annoying as all get out sounds that it repeats for minutes and minutes. Or, for example, one of the tech things that I found so annoying but actually looks really awesome visually is, and they missed this totally, looking forward, looking to the future, they figured, hey, it seems like all the gadgets seem to have buttons on them. So in the future, we're going to put buttons on everything. And there were so many buttons inside this ship that it almost looked like some of the walls weren't actual devices. They were just decorated with buttons. Yeah, it was the most horrible thing, but it looked really nice.
Yeah, it looked like Christmas. It was pretty cool.
It was as if Apple never existed.
And it's stuff like that I just really liked about the film. They actually got one tech thing really right, which blows my mind for early 80s, and that is his stupid remote control for the detonate HAL device is this little bright red calculator.
Yeah.
But think about it. That was a wireless network appliance. That's pretty impressive.
Oh, I know. Yeah. You don't think about these things because it's so commonplace now. But back then, that wouldn't have existed. That was total science fiction. But you could totally do that now. I totally agree with that. Bibby, what did this movie do for you in a positive way?
What I really liked was the use of weightlessness. I mean, there were a lot of scenes where the characters and objects and things like that had to be in complete weightlessness. And I think they did really well with it. I kept trying to look for strings or any sort of evidence that, what they were doing wasn't really what they were doing. And even when Bob Balaban is hovering, and you can't say Bob, you have to say Bob Balaban,
of course,
is hovering in the HAL computer and he's spinning back and forth as he's, setting up rebooting HAL basically. You look at the way he's floating there, and you can tell he's not really hanging there, and he doesn't seem to be stepping on something. But I think it was really well done. I think they have him hung
upside down, is what it kind of looked like, because like his
could be,
face, but
his tie was hanging. They screwed up.
Yeah.
That's why they picked a bald actor.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
So Brian, what's positive for you to take away from this movie?
What's positive from this movie is what it leaves open. I think it is a really good. If they could have made a third one, this was not really the Empire Strikes Back of these series, but it really opened up something that could have been much better, and I think they could really explore some interesting things in the science fiction. I also have to say that this is the second week in a row that we have reviewed a movie that involves two suns. Seems to be a very big running theme in science fiction.
The film sack, you mean?
In the film sack,
and you know, Star Wars, two suns. Right. You know, you got your Crawl, you got your two suns. And then you got this movie. They got the whole new sun, and they do the whole voiceover at the end. They talk about how the new children won't know about the life that we lived before, when there was darkness and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, for some reason, to be science fiction, you have to have two suns.
All right, well, let me run down some of the stuff that people may have missed. This is your moment to be educated on what happened while you weren't looking in 2010. At the start of the movie, Scheider's in short shorts. We have proof. That Russian guy is not really Russian, and his voice is ridiculous. He says wary a lot instead of very. Typical story about a dude going on a dangerous trip and the family being freaked out about it. That happened in this thing. It happens in every movie ever made. Sweet laptop technology at the beach, if you guys remember that. That was sweet. That was way ahead of its time. They had wireless something going on there. I don't know what was going on. They have gone for a look that is very alienish inside the ships. I like that dark, dank stuff. Russians are all hairy, dippy, droopy-eyed bastards. Russian dude on the ship looks like Scheider. I mentioned that already. You could tell right away that John Lithgow was going to die and quick, but he didn't. Favorite moments. Lithgow hyperventilating on the side of the ship. Creepy Hal is awesome when he's getting rebooted. That was freaking awesome.
Yeah.
Too much of the movie is about Russian-American culture clash and winning the Russians over with our way of thinking. That kind of thing drives me nuts. Jupiter shrinks. Yeah, Jupiter shrinks. Lots of paper in the ship when things don't go well. Do you notice that?
So you can turn a fan on. Yeah. Blow it everywhere.
Yeah, turn the fan on. All right, everybody move around like you're crashing. I'm like, dude, somebody stow the damn paper in this place. The big message is Russians and Americans should get along at the end. That seemed like the overall message to me, which really I hated. And it's on giant letters on a stupid screen, and that's stupid. Two films now, and I don't think I still get what the monolith is for. That is what you missed during 2010. The year we make contact. Next year we'll be able to see if this all came true. Quickly, if you had to do a tweet and post it in 140 characters or less, what would you say would sum up this film for you, Randy?
2010, the year we make contact and have no idea why.
All right, that's under 140 characters. Brian?
2010, Randy stole my answer.
There you go again. I kind of agree with Randy's answer over there. That was pretty good.
Yeah. Well, you should never let Randy go first.
I'm letting you go first next.
Brilliant time. At that. Yeah, let me go first. That way I can say something, then he can go, ha ha.
All right. Awesome. No problem. Bibby, what would you sum this up as?
I'd say less sci-fi, more political thriller, and Olga Mann's nerd.
Olga Mann's nerd.
Dr. Chandra, will I dream?
All right, that about does it for another episode of Film Sack. What's up next for us? We are going to be seeing the film Retroglave. It's another troll story.
The Retroglave.
Retrograde.
Okay, so it's not a prequel. Dang it. Retrograde starring Dolph Lundgren, if you can believe it.
Oh, more Russians.
If you've never heard of Dolph or seen this movie with Dolph Lundgren, then do yourself a favor, catch up, and we will see it as well and talk about it on our very next episode. If you want to be a part of the show, send your emails and suggestions and comments to filmsack@gmail.com. Visit us on the web at filmsack.com. That's where you'll find show notes, forums, Twitter accounts, and etc. For all of us here on the Filmsack crew, thank you, everybody, for listening. We can't wait to talk next time about the next really crappy movie that we find at the very bottom of the barrel of Netflix. Until then, everyone, have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Okay, all right, two things. One, I can't get over how in the early 80s, they tried to mention two institutions on Earth that they figured would definitely be around in 2010. Yeah. And the two they named were the Astrodome and Yankee Stadium. And
it's that,
neither baseball... What?
Don't forget Pan Am, too.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's right. Pan Am was going to... Yeah, we actually thought about that, yeah.
Even up until a year ago, no one would have thought that the Yankees wouldn't be playing in Yankee Stadium and the Astros wouldn't be playing in the Astrodome.
And then
the best line from the film, man, without a doubt. Best line from the film, whenever a president's going to get us into serious trouble, they always use Lincoln.
You know I love that. That is...
What? They're all bearded, messy-haired, half-balding... What do you want to do with the ship?